Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 8, Gender and Sex Differences.
One of the most salient characteristics of social animals is specialization of behavioral roles. We've already briefly discussed this idea when examining the theory of group selection, especially as analyzed by George Price. One of the main reasons behind the growing acceptance of Price's model of group selection is the observation that role specialization always accompanies group selection. As Price first pointed out, this is a direct outcome of his model. The fate of the members of a group is directly tied to the fate of the group as a whole, and vice versa. Or, stated in evolutionary terms, the fitness of the individual members of a group is directly tied to the fitness of the group, considered as a single functional unit. For example, one of the most important functional characteristics between aggregations of bacteria and multicellular eukaryotes like us is the fact that the cells of multicellular eukaryotes are highly specialized. This specialization happens despite the fact that all of the cells of a multicellular eukaryote are just related to each other as the cells of an aggregation of bacteria, assuming that the bacteria are a clone, that is, that they've all descended from a single ancestral cell. Consider a large aggregation of bacteria weighing, half a kilogram, about a pound, versus a rat weighing the same amount. What makes the rat different from the pile of bacteria is the fact that the individual cells of the rat are highly specialized. They have differentiated into many different kinds of cells, each performing a different function, including a small population of cells within the rat, which does all the reproducing. By contrast, the bacterial cells do not differentiate, with the result that all of them perform essentially the same roles. That is, they each do all of the things a bacterium must do to survive, and of course, they all reproduce. Kin selection alone is insufficient to explain why the cells of the rat act so differently from the cells of the bacteria. Bacterial cells divide by binary fission, whereas eukaryotic cells divide by mitosis. However, both of these processes have essentially the same outcome. One cell divides into two cells that are genetically identical to each other. Since they are genetically identical, kin selection should operate on both with approximately equal intensity. However, this is clearly not the case, as the cells of the rat are much, much more cooperative and integrated in function than a pile of bacterial cells of approximately equal size. Group selection theory, as modeled in the Price equation, can explain this difference. If it is tied to role specialization, as implied by Price but not explicitly incorporated into his original model. Recall once again the basic principle of group selection, as modeled by the Price equation. That is, that individual fitness is tied to the fitness of the group as a whole. This is why altruists can increase in frequency overall, even when they decrease in frequency relative to the other members of the group of which they are a part. The actions of the altruist enhance the fitness of the group as a whole. And, as President Kennedy was fond of saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. This means that cells that have become so specialized that they can no longer reproduce on their own can still become more common over time if the group of which they are members increases in size. This requires that there be a mechanism by which the non-reproductive cells can continue to be reproduced even though they themselves no longer reproduce. This is why kin selection is an essential part of group selection. The non-reproductive members of a group continue to be produced by the reproductive members of the group that benefit from their altruism, just as Darwin originally suggested. Which brings us back to the importance of role specialization in social evolution. Increasing role specialization at the level of individuals is autocatalytic as group selection proceeds. That is, When selection operates at the level of groups, it has the effect of selecting for increasing degrees of role specialization among individuals that make up the group. This is because increasing specialization enhances survival and reproduction of the group, which in turn sets a stage for further role specialization. In other words, group selection appears to have the inevitable effect of causing role specialization among the members of the group when selection operates on the group rather than exclusively on the individuals of which it is composed. Therefore, we may make the following generalization. Role specialization is both a cause and an effect of social evolution, and therefore increases as social evolution proceeds. To understand how role specialization has led to the evolution of sex differences, we have to go all the way back to the origin of the animals, about 1 billion years ago. Animals today are multicellular eukaryotes, composed of many specialized cells that cooperate to form the tissues, organs, and organ systems that together make up an individual multicellular organism. However, animals are the evolutionary descendants of unicellular, animal-like protozoa that lived in the oceans about 1 billion years ago. All eukaryotes share several structural and functional characteristics, including a two-cell nucleus, mitochondria, or the powerhouses of cells, and cell division by mitosis. However, only animals show distinct structural and functional differences between females and males. Fungi have different mating types, but these are not functionally analogous to females and males. They look just about identical. Plants have tissues and organs that have functions similar to female and male reproductive organs, but most plants have both. They are, in other words, hermaphrodites. Something about the biology of animals, in other words, has predisposed them to the evolution of distinct female and male mating types. At the very beginning of the evolution of animals, our ancestors were single cells that did everything they had to do to survive. They had to find and capture and digest and assimilate other organisms, and they also all reproduced as single cells. The mechanism by which they reproduced is the same one that eukaryotic cells still use to divide, mitosis, which involves the division of the genetic material of a cell contained in structures called chromosomes, followed by the physical division of the cell. In addition to dividing into two identical cells by mitosis, our unicellular protist ancestors also sometimes did the opposite. Two cells would occasionally fuse together to form a single cell containing two complete sets of chromosomes. Lynn Margulis has proposed that this process, called cell fusion, originally evolved because it allows cells to counteract the negative effects of genetic mutations. By fusing together, two cells could use their two complete sets of genetic information to compensate for deleterious mutations in each set. Cells that have two complete sets of chromosomes are called diploid cells, whereas cells that have only one set of chromosomes are called haploid cells. We ourselves are diploid, having received one complete set of genetic material from mom and one complete set of genetic material from dad. This was also true for our unicellular ancestors, except that mom was a single haploid cell and dad was another haploid cell, which fused together to make a diploid cell containing two complete sets of chromosomes. Now, how do we get from fused diploid cells to the haploid cells that can fuse together to form them? A second cell division process evolved, called meiosis, which has the effect of dividing diploid cells into haploid cells with only one set of chromosomes each. Once again, Lynn Margulis has proposed that meiosis evolved originally as a means of separating the two sets of chromosomes in a fused diploid cell, following the comparison and repair of their two sets of genetic material. Furthermore, and this is most important for the later evolution of sex, the two sets of chromosomes are randomly shuffled during meiosis, producing new combinations of the genetic material from both parents. Following DNA repair, made possible by cell fusion, and chromosome shuffling, the diploid cell could then divide by meiosis to form the normal haploid forms, which would then go off and live out their separate lives. In other words, our protist ancestors alternated between two unicellular forms, a unicellular diploid form with two sets of chromosomes, and a unicellular haploid form. Furthermore, these two forms reproduce themselves via two different kinds of cell division. The unicellular haploid forms divided by mitosis, forming genetically identical haploid cells, while the unicellular diploid forms, which had been produced by the fusion of two haploid cells, divided by meiosis, forming genetically variable haploid cells. The specialization of sex cells into female, that is, large and immobile forms, and male, that is, small and mobile forms, was both the first and most important consequence of group selection in the origin of animals, and set the stage for much of the further evolution of animals that followed it. When our distant ancestors were still unicellular protists, the haploid cells that were produced by mitosis and meiosis separated from each other, producing free-living unicellular haploid protozoa. When some of these unicellular haploid cells fused together to form a diploid cell, it was also unicellular. What eventually made them into true animals was that the founders of the kingdom Animalia didn't separate following a cell division. They stayed attached to each other, forming a multicellular confederacy, a body, in other words. There are still arguments about how this occurred, but the smart money is on the evolution of proteins that allowed the cells to stick together and communicate with each other, thereby allowing a loose confederation of cells to function as if they were a single unit. We can still see examples of this original form of multicellularity in things like sponges and the jellyfish that live in oceans today. At this point, a crucial branch point in evolution occurred. Among the ancestors of animals, the diploid form was the one in which multicellularity evolved as a result of mitosis and cell adhesion. The reason this branch point is crucial is that it tied the diploid form to multicellularity, and therefore tied the production of haploid reproductive cells to meiosis. Plants evolved differently, and in the fullness of time, evolved sexual reproduction twice. Once when they were tiny cellular confederacies living in the water, and later on when they were huge multicellular organisms adapted to life on land. Animals, by chance, stumbled on a mechanism that had two complementary outcomes. The alternation of a large multicellular diploid form with a small unicellular haploid form, and a process of cell division going from the former to the latter, that is meiosis, that tremendously increased the genetic variability between offspring. At first, the cells of the large multicellular diploid forms were virtually identical in structure and function. That's why we call them confederacies. The confederacies, or bodies, of which cells were members increased in size, as this allowed them to store more resources in their tissues, made predation on other animals easier while at the same time reducing their vulnerability to predation, and allowed the confederacies to survive the deaths of some of their members. And as they evolved by group selection, the individual cells became more specialized. A crucial thing to notice about these multicellular confederacies, what we're calling bodies here, is that not all of their cells retain the ability to reproduce. The cells that can do this, usually called sex cells, or germ cells sometimes, started out as nearly identical haploid cells, but quickly differentiated into two types. Large cells that could not move around under their own power, we call these egg cells, or ova, and small cells that do have the ability to swim around using long whip-like tails called flagella. We call these sperm cells, or spermatozoa. On a purely functional level, what distinguishes females from males is that females have large, non-mobile reproductive cells, whereas males have smaller, mobile reproductive cells. This specialization of function between female and male sex cells is a derived characteristic. That is, it evolved from an ancestral form in which there were no such size and function differences. This strongly implies that the specialization into female and male forms is adaptive, which leads to an obvious question. Why have almost all animals separated into distinct female and male forms, whereas plants, fungi, and other organisms have not? What evolutionary advantage does this distinction confer on the two different forms? The answer, once again, is a direct implication of Price's theory of group selection. The specialization of mating cell types into male and female forms conferred an adaptive advantage on the groups of which they were a part, rather than each individual form. And what were these groups that derived such a benefit from specialization into female and male parts? Well, they were the multicellular confederacies, the bodies from which the sex cells were derived. Price was quite clear about this implication in his original paper, in which he presented and explained his covariance equation. He pointed out that cells stand in the same relationship with the bodies from which they're derived as individual organisms stand with the groups of which they're a member. In both cases, the fates of the groups and the fates of the individuals that make them up are inextricably tied together. As the name covariance implies, they vary together. Changes at one level are necessarily tied to changes at the other. Having one type of haploid sex cell that is large and immobile and another haploid type that is small and mobile increases the efficiency of reproduction that results from their fusion. The large, relatively immobile form, what we call egg cells, can store large amounts of food for the developing embryo, but they can't move around very well, which limits their distribution in space, but also limits their exposure to potential predators and other dangers. By contrast, the small, relatively mobile form, what we call sperm cells, can disperse widely in space, thereby increasing the probability of encountering other egg cells, but can't store much food to stay alive long or to fuel development during cell fusion. And moving around more exposes them to potential predators and other dangers. Logically, a confederacy of cells, that is, a multicellular animal, could either produce egg cells or sperm cells or both. And a few of them do. Once again, the specialization argument explains why the either-or, but not both option, is the one that evolved in most animals. Producing egg cells requires different cell division processes and makes different demands on the confederation, the body, than producing sperm cells. Since egg cells are larger and contain more materials, they can only be produced in small numbers, whereas sperm cells can be made in huge numbers. Females, in other words, specialize in making small numbers of egg cells with a higher chance of survival because of their food supply and reduced exposure to dangers, whereas males specialize in making large number of sperm cells with a lower chance of survival because of their lack of food and increased exposure to dangers. Furthermore, because of the amount of resources that are devoted to eggs, females generally have a much more limited reproductive capacity than males. Females can only produce so many eggs, while the number of sperm that a male can produce is immensely larger. As we'll see in the next lecture, these differences are magnified among vertebrates and especially among mammals. Once animals had differentiated into structurally and functionally different mating types, what we call females and males, the differences between these two mating types affected the evolution of animals in many important ways. In the context of the following lectures, the most important effect of this role specialization is sexual selection, which, as the name implies, can only exist if there are separate and functionally distinct sexes. As we will see in the next lecture, sexual selection has had an enormous impact on the evolution of animals, and especially on the evolution of humans and human behavior. What I would like to spend the rest of this lecture doing is showing how the differentiation of animals, including humans, into females and males, has consequences for the evolution of human behavior and the mind that produces it. Indeed, as we will see, it is not too far-fetched to assert that the anatomical and physiological differences between females and males, which date back almost a billion years, combined with the more recent effects of sexual selection among our primate ancestors, has resulted in the evolution of structurally and functionally different female and male bodies and minds. Furthermore, there are both theoretical and empirical reasons to infer that this distinction is firmly grounded in the biology of animal reproduction. Before going further, it's time to distinguish between two linked but separate concepts, gender and sex. In the context of evolutionary psychology, gender describes a behavioral role, whereas sex describes a biological role. A description of a gender is primarily a description of behavior, what females and males do, as contrasted with what they are. By contrast, a description of a sex is primarily a description of how females and males function, especially at an anatomical, genetic, and physiological level. Gender and sex are related, but not necessarily identical, nor directly mappable onto one another. As many people are aware, gender behaviors are not necessarily tied to biological sex. For example, transvestites and transgendered people exhibit behaviors that are more often associated with members of the opposite sex. Women wearing men's clothing, for example, or men acting and speaking in ways that appear more feminine than masculine. Nor are these distinctions limited to humans. There are many examples of transgendered behavior among other animals. As you might expect based on previous lectures, evolutionary psychologists, like ethologists, begin with the assumption that gender differences are partly innate and partly learned. To be more precise, gender roles are learned, but such learning is both facilitated and constrained by innate tendencies arising from the different evolutionary histories of females and males. This viewpoint, of course, directly contradicts the standard social science model, whose supporters assert that there are no significant differences between female and male humans, either in behavior or in cognitive capabilities, that are not entirely learned via cultural conditioning. Recent empirical research has shown otherwise. Females and males differ in a number of characteristics, especially behaviors involved with food procurement and geographical orientation, mating and sexual reproduction, child rearing, and aggressive behavior. Furthermore, these differences can be correlated with selective pressures arising from the biology and ecology of our evolutionary ancestors. Almost no one would argue that there aren't any significant anatomical or physiological differences between females and males. Females are not as tall as males on average. They have less body hair than males. They have thinner, darker, and less oily skin, more body fat, especially just under the skin, and lower blood pressure, metabolic rates, and body temperatures than males. There are also biological differences in male and female nervous systems. Although females and males have approximately equal brain-to-body ratios, Females have relatively larger Wernicke's and Broca's areas, the parts of the brain that are adapted for language, whereas males have relatively larger left inferior parietal lobes, the parts of the brain adapted for sensory and motor processing, manipulations of objects, and orientation in space. Finally, there are, of course, very significant differences in the reproductive physiology and capability of females and males. Females reach sexual maturity at younger ages than males, but generally do not retain the ability to reproduce past middle age. Females are also limited as to the number of offspring they can successfully produce, a limit defined by the number of offspring that can be conceived and carried simultaneously, not more than 6 and generally less than 2. The spacing between pregnancies, not less than 9 months and averaging about 4 years worldwide, and the total length of time between menarche and menopause, generally between 20 and 30 years. Males, by contrast, are physiologically capable of producing immensely larger numbers of offspring. The largest number of children fathered by one man is over 800, all of them fathered by Moulay Ismail ibn Sharif, the third ruler of the Moroccan Alawite dynasty from 1672 to 1727. Whether there are behavioral and cognitive differences between females and males is considerably more controversial. As I stated earlier, supporters of the standard social science model assert that all behavioral aspects of gender are purely learned via cultural conditioning, and that therefore evolutionary psychology cannot contribute to an understanding of gender differences in behavior. However, it should be clear by now that even if gender-specific behaviors are learned, the basic mechanism of imprinted learning, that is, an inherited tendency to learn certain types of behavior more easily and in specific ways, in specific contexts, can still produce learning behaviors that have evolutionary significance. We will focus on some of the gender differences in courtship, mating, and parenting behavior in the next few lectures, and in later chapters, we will also consider some gender differences in psychopathology. For now, let's consider just a few of the gender differences that have been studied by evolutionary psychologists and see if we can correlate these with what we now understand about the evolution of behavioral tendencies in humans. Throughout the following, it is important to keep in mind that the differences that we're discussing represent average differences. There is considerable overlap between female and male distributions for most of the behaviors discussed. As we've already seen, locating and procuring food is an essential activity in humans. Detailed analysis of the food procurement behaviors of living hunter-gatherers indicates that there's a significant gender-related difference in these behaviors. In general, females gather food resources, especially plants, by foraging in the near environment. By contrast, males hunt animals for food, often traveling long distances as they do so. This implies that females should have different perceptual and orientation abilities than males, differences that could be empirically tested. Several different teams of researchers have tested the abilities of females and males to recall the identity and location of arrays of objects in the near environment. Some of these tests have involved paper or computer diagrams of objects located in space, whereas others have actually tested female and male abilities to find multiple objects hidden in a patchy environment. In nearly all cases, females have demonstrated a significantly greater ability to find and remember the locations of such scattered and hidden objects. Other tests have investigated whether there are differences between females and males in their ability to navigate and orient over long distances. In these tests, males have demonstrated consistent, significantly greater ability to navigate over long distances and to orient themselves relative to home. In particular, males seem more able to visualize their surroundings as if they had an aerial view using directional coordinates, such as north and south, to orient themselves. Females, by contrast, tend to use landmarks and descriptions of pathways to navigate and orient themselves, and especially to find specific objects located in an already known environment. Living in social groups requires social skills, especially in communication. Investigations and psychological tests have generally indicated that females report feeling a greater intensity of emotion and express their emotions more easily and more often than males, especially in social situations. Females also score higher than males in agreeableness, measured as compassion and cooperation, and also in feeling anxiety, anger, and depression. Females tend to talk more at home and in one-on-one conversations, whereas males tend to talk more in larger social groups. Ethological studies of human conversations have also shown that females tend to converse face-to-face with more eye contact and closer physical adjustments of distance between speakers. Males, by contrast, tend to avoid eye contact when speaking and to talk past each other while maintaining a greater individual distance. Females also tend to stick to single topics of conversation for longer periods of time, while males change subjects more often and with single warnings of topic change. And finally, females tend more often to express agreement, especially with group decisions and positions, whereas males are prone to debate over disagreements and to remain obdurate longer in the face of social pressure. There are also observable differences between females and males in types of cognition and in overall patterns of social behavior. Females and males generally do not exhibit significant differences on intelligence tests, especially when such tests are controlled for cultural differences, age, and social class. However, females, on the average, score higher on measures of verbal fluency and ability to empathize with others. Males, by contrast, tend to score higher on tests of mathematical ability and on ability to organize and categorize objects and ideas, often referred to as systematizing. Overall, females are generally happier than males and express greater concern for family and personal values, whereas males, on average, express greater concern for political and wider social issues. Males in most cultures also tend to have more social rights and corresponding responsibilities than females. This is particularly true in the context of religion, in which males are almost always found in dominant roles relative to females. However, this particular pattern of gender differentiation is also quite sensitive to cultural and subsistence patterns, a sensitivity that we will see has environmental and evolutionary implications as well. Males are generally more physically aggressive and are more prone to taking risks, especially during and after puberty, but before they've fathered children. Traits that are reflected in the actuarial statistics of insurance companies. Although both females and males commit crimes, males commit the overwhelming majority of violent crimes, especially murder, and are much more likely to die violently than females. Females are more likely to attempt suicide, but males are much more likely to succeed in killing themselves. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, males almost exclusively engage in group violence and organized warfare. In particular, males organize, participate in, lead, and tend to divide the spoils of war with little or no female input. Indeed, females play at most a supportive role in organized violence and warfare, while involuntarily suffering equal or even greater negative consequences from it. And one last related difference. When rape happens, it is males that forcibly rape females, both singly and in groups. Females virtually never forcibly rape males. As I stated earlier, we've barely scraped the surface in this lightning review of gender and sex differences in humans. we will return to many of the themes touched on earlier and see how they are related to our evolutionary past. For now, let's sum up by saying that gender and sex role differentiation and specialization is quite literally a natural outgrowth of the evolution of social groups, especially, but not exclusively, in humans. We will see in the next few lectures how these differences have evolved, both by simple natural selection and by sexual selection, and we will see how an understanding of how our differently gendered sexual behaviors have evolved and can, if we're both lucky and mindful, show us how to live more amicably with each other. Women and men may not ever completely agree with each other. Indeed, it may be that our evolved nature makes full agreement impossible. But perhaps we can at least agree to disagree in ways that are less damaging to ourselves, to society, and especially to our children.
This ends Lecture 8.